August 18th, 2016. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Poke Runyon. And tonight, we will review new issues of old Hermetic magic books. Starting with Zoroaster's Telescope, 1796-2013, and on to Urania's Mirror, 1822-2004. And finally, the Harmonia Macrocosmica of Solarius, 1660-2013. Now, the first item on our list is more of a board game than a book. A very elaborate and frankly confusing French divinatory system that uses hexagonal tiles with magical and astrological data drawn from an urn or a box and applied to a board called a mirror, which has hexagonal compartments. Now, divination follows from the numbers in the mirror cells and the pattern various tiles make on the mirror. Urania's Mirror is a small book describing the astrological constellations and their mythology, accompanied by a set of 32 cards on which the mythical figures of the zodiac are depicted in a very romantic style. Now, this style is influenced by our last selection, the Harmonia Macrocosmica of Andreas Solarius, a magnificently illustrated atlas of the heavens. So, if you'd like to explore some of the recent revivals of ancient wisdom, stay with us and we'll have a look. All right, now, to start off with, we'll talk about Zoroaster's telescope. I don't mind saying right at the outset when I call this book confusing. It is very confusing. In fact, it's so confusing that I suspect that the author himself was somewhat confused. In fact, if the system is actually valid, workable, if it is, then I doubt that André de Nerciat was actually who is credited with authoring it. He was a novelist, what they call a libertine novelist at that. You know, this is the 18th century, and he's credited with this. I kind of suspect that maybe he didn't write it. He got it from somewhere else, and tried to understand it himself, and I don't think he did. I don't think he did. Anyway, I'm going to read the introduction to the. By the way, this is a very nice little book put out by Ouroboros Press, and they came out with it in 2013. So this is the introduction that is written by John Leary of Ouroboros Press. Zoroaster's Telescope is a wonderfully strange book of oracle magic, written in 1796 by André Robert Andrea de Nercier, a French author of the libertine genre. The text later appeared in a collection of German folk literature compiled by Johann Schliebe, from which this English translation was made. The 18th century was an active time for occultism. Magicians and fortune tellers of note were spread throughout Europe, often playing significant roles in historical or political events. This was the era of the Comte Saint-Germain, Cagliostro, Anton Court-de-Gablin, Etiella, Louis Claude de Saint-Martin, Manuel Swedenborg, and Adam Weishaupt, who were known for their visionary and magical prowess or accuracy in divining the future. It is a curious fact that the two genres of eroticism cult often overlap, as in the case of the author of the present text. But this did not prevent him from giving advice on bodily desires of food and love, as well as moralizing on the disadvantages of non-restraint. While ancient divination systems such as the geomancy and hepatoscopy have been around for centuries, the 18th century was giving way to new forms of occult science, such as the Odic light and the magnetism of Baron Karl von Reichenbach and Franz Mesmer. Tarocco, the tarot game from Italy, was also just coming into its own as a system of fortune-telling with the publication of Le Monde Primitif and Elisabeth Campere avec Le Monde Moderne by Anton Court de Gebelin. Please excuse my French. It is very good. I remember I took French. I took a French class one time, and the teacher looked at me and she said, "Comment allez-vous?" And I said, "Très bien." You said? So that's the extent of my French. And tarot cards. Not long after this publication came out, even though the present author, Robert Andre, the Nersiat, seemed to hold a rather dim view of activities such as tarot and palmistry, as revealed twice in the text. You know, his system was vastly superior. He appears to have a high regard for his particular amalgamation of divinatory Kabbalah and spiritual astrology. Some of his statements appear as though they might be in direct contrast to actual Jewish thought, such as the day starting with the first ray of light, making one ponder what sources for some of his ideas might be. This unusual fusion of religious and mystical ideas presented within the divination system are illustrated in the text by various woodcuts and instructive tables. And these woodcuts have their own charm and their visual beehive theme, but are necessary for understanding how the oracle works, if you can. These woodcuts have names like the Great Mirror, the Great Guide, and the urn, which call to mind a romantic notion of Kabbalah and magic. The Zoroaster's telescope claims to be the key to the great divinatory Kabbalah of the Magi. And indeed, within the text, we find an eclectic mix of angel magic, astrology, divination, 28 measures of the moon, Kabbalah, Zoroastrianism, sacred geometry, numerology, reminiscent of the syncretism the Gregor Mathers employed in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn at the close of the 19th century. Now, what he's referring to there is those the Enochian tablets where Mathers took those Enochian tablets and attributed all sorts of astrological correspondences to them. Zoroaster's telescope was rarely cited in the English-speaking countries, which probably slowed its inclusion into mainstream esoteric resources in these countries. Ernst Rainer mistitled the plates in his book Symbols, Signs, and Signets, calling them Zoroaster's Oracle, and the similarity of that name with Wynne Westcott's book, often issued under the name The Chaldean Oracles of Zoroaster, caused some confusion. And while the book is an oracle and does have the name Zoroaster in the title, the similarity ends there. It has been noted by Stuart Kaplan and others of the similarity of such diverse games as cards, chess, draughts, dice, and dominoes, a sort of thick card, if you will, and their possible common origins. It is here we can see a crossover to the draft-like pieces in Zoroaster's telescope. which are laid out in specific patterns, each hexagonal piece showing its rotation of rank, degrees, and astrological correspondences. With these compositions referred to in the text as mirrors, the Kabbalist reads and interprets through their placement in astrological houses and lunar mansions in order to see into the future. And as we peer into Zoroaster's telescope and the great mirror, we indeed find ourselves gazing directly into a looking glass and the ancient concept of know thyself. And there is little doubt that the author saw these activities as a spiritual practice. The book opens with an explanation of how the oracle is composed and how the operator is to be inspired, comparing its composition to music. Then text reminds one of instructions one might find in a grimoire when mentioning the names of the principal pieces and how they are to be constructed and what they are to be made of. And the similarities continue with the designation of spirits, intelligences, geniuses, houses of the day and night, mansions of the moon, and their angelic correspondences, as well as the meanings of various numbers, spheres, and planetary forces. All this makes it apparent that Zoroaster's telescope is an oracle and a divinatory tool for bringing the operator closer to the divine, a medium or agency, if you will, for receiving messages and revelation directly from God, special providence. This is an unusual but precise method to obtain answers or to inquiries, to access occult knowledge and insight of a practical nature. Here is an attempt at divine communication, to see into the future circumstances using the divine or simply as a guide to making the navigation of life's obstacles a little easier. And that's John Leary's foreword to the book. The author has an introduction. I think that Leary's introduction is a little bit more to our point than the author's. Now, I will confess that I have read this little book. It's not that large. It's a little quarto size volume, which Ouroboros Press does very well, by the way, these small books. And it's only 120 some pages long, and I've read the whole thing. Even if I had all of these tiles you might want to call them hexagonal chips or tiles. Even if I had them, I wouldn't pretend to be able to figure out how to do this. And you can't, from the way the book is written, it would take a year's experimenting and studying to begin to figure out how to do it. It's a beautiful little book, and it has a big fold-out, by the way. And right in the front, they have a big 11x17 fold-out showing the urn. And that, of course, is a great big beehive-looking structure of hexagonal divisions, which you can fill with these various, which you can actually make these chips out of. And there are 99 of them. And if you really want to get into this, really, really want to get into this, somebody, and I'm not sure that it's Ouroboros Press, somebody's offering a set, the book, a leather-bound copy of the book, and a very ornate-looking box of all the tiles. And I think they have about a $3,000 price tag on that little set. So if you wanted to really get into this thing, you could do that. However, I would think that if you really want to get into it and really do it, you would take and photocopy the, you know, photocopy the urn and photocopy some of the other tiles in the book, and then spray stick it and mount them on you know, stiff board, and cut out all these make your own little chips and work it this way. I think it's very possible that this system really does work. And one of the reasons why I think that it is possible that it does is that it seems to have a kind of an intuition of its own, somewhat like why does tarot work? Why does geomancy work? For that matter, why does astrology work? I mean, why do any of these divinatory systems work? And we have to ask ourselves, well, in the question of astrology, I think we know the answer to that. We've been keeping data on astrology ever since the Paleolithic, and passing it down, and we've learned over the past 22,000 years that when such and such astrological conditions are astronomical relationships are present, then certain things can be predicted. And you collect enough of that data, and that means that astrology, as we have said before on the Hermetic Hour, astrology is a science, because all science does is it says, okay, if we do this, if we take this piece of wood and drive it into this square hole, such and such is going to happen. And we know that, and we don't know why, but we know it does. And so that's science. I know that sound. I know a scientist would want to hear that. He'd want to barf. But that's the truth. So many scientific ideas, theories, and are based upon inexplicable relationships. Now, these inexplicable relationships, that's what we're looking at here with Zoroaster's telescope. As I said, this is a sort of almost like casting the runes or laying out a tarot spread. There's a system here, and my problem with the book. Now, of course, one of the things the book was originally written in French. It was translated into German, and then from the German, it was brought back into English. Was brought into English. And I can imagine that a lot was lost in these various translations. I remember a friend of mine, and I won't mention his name. You all know who he is, but a friend of mine had a lady friend who wrote novels, and he once joked about that she was having her novels. She wrote them in English, but she was having them translated into French because she thought they lost something in the original English. And that's, you know, kind of a translation, kind of a joke. But really, it's unfortunate that we don't seem to have the original French version of this. We have to take the German version of the French version and translate the German version into English. Now, another thing about this that I don't particularly like is that the author continually refers to the Great Kabbalah. And this is that follows the Great Kabbalah, and his Great Kabbalah doesn't sound like any Great Kabbalah I'm familiar with. And I'm just going to read you a little bit here on page 50. Give you an idea of what his Great Kabbalah might be like. Up to this point, we have only dealt with the dry part of our science, namely in the topography of the Great Mirror. Now more interesting objects present themselves. But before going there, an old prejudice must be destroyed. If the candidate already has a concept of divinatory astrology, or also merely of physical astronomy, it must appear strange to him at the beginning that neither the astrology of the ancients nor modern astronomy can be recognized in the organization of the Great Mirror. On that point, we counter with the following. 1. The Great Kabbalah reaches back into a much greater antiquity than any human science. 2. Modern astronomy pursues an entirely different direction than the Great Kabbalah because it strives to ignore the mystical part of the science of the skies, and perhaps because this realm is beyond the typical person who can only rest an interest in pure astronomy because of its practical uses. Right from the start, judicial astrology, and of course that's selective astrology, took an active interest in the Great Kabbalah. Now that's true. However, imposters abused the science, robbing it of its reputation with the populace. And also, that divination through the stars is held to be the game as divination through cards. Good God. Let not this key fall into the hands of charlatans. But now we return to the matter at hand. Well, you're right about one thing. Judicial astrology did concern itself with Kabbalah, but not the Great Kabbalah he's talking about. And how of course magicians, judicial astrology is magical astrology. So he's kind of saying a pox on all your houses, and quite frankly, I keep wanting, I keep looking all through the book and, all right, what's the pattern? What are the, he talks about orbits, he talks about paths, he talks about triangles, he talks about geometric patterns in the matrix. He talks about all these things, but he doesn't explain them. As I said, my impression that I get from the beautiful book, and it has beautiful charts and engravings in it, and he has his own Shemiham Farash, the only angel. He makes up angels. He's very, very clever at making up angel names and what have you. But the only angel from tradition that he has is Gabriel. All the rest of them he makes up. And my impression, as I said, from reading this, and is that he learned this system, the supposed author, he learned this system from somebody, or inherited it. He inherited it. Maybe he bought it in a secondhand bookstore or something. I don't know, but he got this. And then he has in turn tried to explain something that he himself does not understand, and that's the impression I'm getting with this book. I don't, and yet, on the other hand, I've run across, just as an example, in the fourth book attributed to Henry Cornelius Agrippa, There is a system of astrological divination and an astrological matrix, if you will. Well, it's a for ceremonial use and for setting up ceremonies, judicial astrology, which I frankly cannot figure out, and I must have spent a year just trying to figure this thing out, and I was really, I was wondering, well, what's the matter with me? Why can't I figure it out? And then finally, Don Tyson came out with his annotated version of the fourth book attributed to Agrippa, and he couldn't figure it out either. So I thought, well, my gosh, if Don can't figure it out, I'm not going to feel so bad about not figuring out. That's the way I am with Zoroaster's telescope, the same way I was with Agrippa's system in the fourth book. It's just, I can't grasp, but I think that it's that it may have, it may very well work, because a lot of times, how are you gonna define, a lot of people can't figure out why geomancy works. I think I have an understanding of that, but I know people that can't figure it out. I try to explain to them this binary. And that binary is the root of the whole, yes, no, positive, negative, one, two, and all this is the building blocks of the whole universe, and that's what makes it work. So there may be something behind this system in relation to basic numerology. And that, by the way, is the one thing that may be going on here. If you recall from Paul Christian's History and Practice of Magic, he indicates that Cagliostro and the French magicians around that time were very much into numerology. And I think maybe that might be the key to Zoroaster's. That might be what he's talking about when he's talking about the Great Kabbalah. He may be just talking about 18th century French numerology. Maybe very, very well. Anyway, let's enough of Zoroaster's telescope. It, as I said, it's from Ouroboros Press. It's a nice little hardback, kind of limited edition. And let's move on to Urania's mirror now. Urania's mirror is available in two different formats, two different editions. One from Barnes & Noble, which is actually a kit at the Night Sky, in which you get the book, the 32 cards, constellation cards, and a planisphere that the Barnes & Noble people put together with a window in it that you can and the constellations reproduced on the planisphere in miniature, and so you can calculate what stars you're looking at any time during the year. And this is a very nice kit, and the other format that the Urania's mirror comes in is a box called the Box of Stars, and the Box of Stars has a nice blue book with a blue cover called A Practical Guide to the Night Sky and Its Myths and Legends by Catherine Tennant. Now, what Catherine Tennant, and this, by the way, comes from Little Brown Publishers. This is 2004, I believe. That's what they. What do we have down for that? I'm going to get the date right on this and the publishing. Yeah, Little Brown and Company, Boston, New York, and London. And it was copyright 1993 by Catherine Tennant, and then the first American printing came out in 2000. Now, what Catherine Tennant did was she completely rewrote the original book. The original book, good as Mirror. So Catherine totally rewrote it. And I'm not saying she did an inferior job, but if you want to get the original, the 1832 facsimile of the original, and then you go to the Barnes & Noble Night Sky kit. And this, the cards are absolutely beautiful. The cards are watercolors, watercolor etchings, and they have the stars. What she did, all the stars of the constellation are perforated according to their magnitude. And this is really quite a project. So what you can do with one of these constellation cards is hold it up toward the light. In fact, I'm going to do that right now. I have Orion, and I'm holding Orion, holding the lion, and I'm holding Orion up to the light, and I'm seeing Bellatrix and Betelgeuse in one shoulder and the other, and I'm seeing the lion, and I'm seeing all of this, and this, then you can take this, you can hold a flashlight behind it, say, go out in the night sky, look up at Orion, and you get a really good fix on it. And the cards, as I say, they're a combination of etchings and watercolor. And they were all put together by this Victorian lady. She did it and did the cards. And then she got an astrologer friend of hers to do the book, the little book, Uranus Mirror. I'm going to read a Uranus Mirror. I'm going to read to you the foreword about my Heather Water for the original, the facsimile of the original. Okay, the beautiful constellation cards included in A View of the Heavens, a Night Sky Kit, were created by an anonymous young English lady and were accompanied by a guidebook written by Jehoshaphat Aspen, the author of many works on history and geography. It was first published in London by Samuel Lee in 1825. The first North American edition was produced in 1832 and is reprinted here. When the ancient Greek Aratus wrote his complete description of the sky, the oldest that has come down to us, he was participating in a long history of stargazing and cosmic lore, at least as old as the ancient Mesopotamian civilizations. And no one knows when the named groups of stars were associated with the pictures we now associate with them. The Greeks and their ancient successors added new constellations to the sky, a practice taken up later by the Renaissance and Enlightenment astronomers like Bayer, Helvetius, and Lassiel. Now astronomers have agreed on 88 standard constellations, most of which can be seen in our hemisphere and appear on the constellation cards in the kit. Each card features a beautifully executed watercolor image of each constellation, as interpreted in classical mythology. As an added feature, the stars on the cards are perforated according to their relative magnitude. The scale of relative magnitude measures brightness. It originated in ancient times and was generally from 1, the brightest, to 6, the dimmest. Nowadays, this system has been enhanced, and there are more minute degrees of magnitude, including even negative magnitude, such as that of the brightest star, Sirius. And the enclosed planisphere, decorated with many of the constellation illustrations, is designed 42 degrees latitude in the northern hemisphere. And with a little adjusting, it can be used for most locations in this hemisphere. It shows the stars in their fixed relation to one another. The center of the planisphere shows Polaris, the North Star. It is the tip of the tail of Ursa Minor, the little bear, also known as the Big Dipper. When you are facing Polaris, you know you are facing north. The rest of the stars appear to be moving in a circular path around Polaris. To use the planisphere, simply align the top part of the time of the day you're viewing with the bottom part. The date shows you the window, the top part, and you can see the sky in the evening. Hold the planisphere vertically in front of you in the direction that you're facing, and the center of the window shows what is directly overhead in the zenith. Now, locating the constellations using the planisphere is not difficult, but it takes a little familiarity with the terms. Let's take the constellation Hercules, Plate 11. And so the rest of this is technical to the it's technical to the nature of the work. The circle of tick marks in the planisphere is the ecliptic, the apparent path of the sun, and so. Not only do we hope that this kit will make the study of astronomy familiar and amusing, but it will also capture the romance of the heavens, which helped the people from ancient times onward navigate the seas while serving as a canvas for their legends and their dreams. And using this kit, we invite you to explore the night sky through the eyes of charming illustrations from times past. Now, that gives a pretty good idea of what this is about, but quite frankly, we have found that these cards are in their own way, just in their own way, they're just as important as the tarot in magic. Because you can take these cards and put them on the altar. You could use them anytime you project. You know, and if we do a projection off to a constellation or something like that, or do astral time travel, these cards are actually a magical device, just like we often put tarot cards on top of the altar, or we put them around the circle, and we can use these cards the same way, and you can apply to the zodiac. So I think that either the box of stars, or you can get, if you get the kit from Barnes and Noble, View the Night Sky, you get the original Urania's mirror with the cards and the book. Either way, you get the cards, but if you want to get the original book, then you would certainly go for the Barnes and Noble kit with the planisphere. Now we come to. La Poste de Resistance. Andreas Salerius. Harmonium Macrocosmia. This is, well, I'm straining to pick it up. This is it's a huge book. It's 11 by 17, literally. Yeah, 11 by 17, I really encourage you to go take a look at it on the internet. It's not. They don't have a PDF of this whole thing, but they've got enough illustrations from it. And as soon as you see some of those illustrations, you will know that you've seen them before. And also, there doesn't seem to be any doubt in my mind, looking at the illustrations from Salerius, and this is 1660 that these were done. And these are etchings. They're colored etchings, very similar in a way. They're very similar to what the Victorian lady did with her, the anonymous Victorian lady did with her cards. It is 11 by 17. So Foundry doesn't believe me. She's measuring. 19. Oh, 19? Oh, you mean I got a couple extra inches? Well, maybe even bigger than. Yeah, the paper, I believe, is 11 by 17, but the book, the whole book with the covers extending over it is 19 inches. I strongly, even though it's expensive, and it's if you are really into celestial magic, this is something I believe you really have to have. And let's talk a little bit about the author. And here again, he had to have an artist. He had several artists working for him. The author, Andreas Solarius, was originally, he was born in a German town near Worms back in the early 1600s. And he was primarily an engineer, and the books where he started his publications was designs and publications designs on fortifications. He was designing forts. Now in those days, of course, this was right before the 30 Years' War, and the thing about the 30 Years' War is it went on for 30 years, and you know who's burying Grant's tomb? Actually, Grant and his wife. The 30 Years' War, you know, the thing, it went on for 30 years, and nobody knows what Solarius was doing during the 30 Years' War, but he was probably designing fortifications for the various people who were fighting and the various countries that were fighting. But finally, after the war was finally kind of resolved, he moved to Holland, took up residence in Holland, and he began to work on, and he like Agrippa, he was a clergyman and a soldier and a military engineer, and also too he was quite a not an astronomer, but a cartographer, I think that's the best way to put it. So what he was commissioned by somebody who was doing an encyclopedic sort of a series of books, and it fell to him to do the celestial atlas. So he proceeded to create this thing, and it is, like I say, it's a huge book, but it is really, if you really, really want to get into to Renaissance astrology and magical imagery and the heavens and all that, if you want to see where the ladies Urania's mirror cards came from, see all these characters in action, that you really need to look at this book. And what Solarius did was he brought this up to date, even though he realized that the Catholic Church would not care they wouldn't care for anything to do with Copernicus at that time, but Solarius had felt he was obligated to also present the Copernican system. So he had Ptolemy's, he illustrated Ptolemy's system with these beautiful illustrations. Then he illustrated Tycho Brahe, who was a Renaissance astrologer before Copernicus, and he had his system. And then he did the Copernican system. And, I don't think the Catholic Church liked it very much, but Athanasius Kircher, the Jesuit, he recommended the book. So I don't think the Catholics were that hurt by it, but Solarius was fair to, he's going to present all sides. And one of the things about this book that I want to mention and draw attention to is, I'm flipping through. I've got this thing marked somewhere. I'm going to find it. I'll find out where the mark is. There is a projection of all the signs of the zodiac. All the signs of the zodiac onto the Northern Hemisphere. And these projections of the signs, constellations, with the artwork showing the mythological figures, and along with the constellations, very much like Urania's card, and there's many of these, but the one particular one I want to try to. Is there a? I'm trying to get Zandria to help me here, because I want to get to this one particular page here. I marked it, but now the mark fell out, so we don't know where it is. But if I can't get to it, I'll just describe it from memory, but I wanted to mention what page it's on for those of you who have the book or are going to get it. Is a projection. It's a projection of all of the constellations onto the Earth itself, and so what you end up doing is it's like you're taking the celestial sphere and you're projecting it down, you're projecting it down onto the Earth. And so what you have here is, and the interesting thing about that to us is we have a system of gridding the celestial sphere, where we grid the celestial sphere, and we call it the Soma Sophia. And this particular plate that Solarius has is very important to our to our concept of the Soma Sophia. And in this, and I want to mention, along with that, I'd like to mention Dee and Kelly's terrestrial victory in comparison with that. Dee and Kelly, I'm going to give up on this. Dee and Kelly came up with this system whereby they took these aethers, actually they took them from Valentinian Gnosticism, these 30 divisions, and somehow, although these divisions were ascending, that's it, I think. No, that's not, this just looks like it. These different aethers going from Teyuts to Lele, for those of you who are familiar with the aether system, they ascend all the way from the lowest level of the astral plane all the way up to, I think that's it, all the way up to that's not it. We're still looking for it, but we're close. Oh, I give up. Forget. We keep thinking we got this. But what they did was they went taking this Gnostic Aeon system, 30 aeons of Valentinian Gnosticism. And they went from the lowest level, which they called Teets, text, T-E-X, all the way up to Lele at the top, and that's an Empyrean, that's the Empyrean level. In other words, they were ascending higher and higher and higher on this aeon scale. And for some incredible reason, which I have never been able to figure out, why they thought that they could apply each one of these aethers and the governors of these aethers to various countries on the surface of the earth. This is completely completely erroneous analogy, and yet they did. They thought they could, and they even tried to sell this system to the Polish government as a political magic, you know. The aether system is an ascension of rarefied dimensions, and which all of us who engage in it, we're aware of that. And now, what's important about Solarius is that Solarius actually did what he and Kelly were trying to do. He projected the constellations to all of those countries that Dee and Kelly were trying to do with what they call terrestrial victory, which was actually the aether system. And Solarius actually did this. Now in order to do this, you have to establish a prime meridian. Now right now the prime meridian, we all agree it goes through Greenwich. But back in Solarius's time, it went right through the Canary Islands, the farthest point westward that the ancients were aware of was Canary Islands. Now, if you want to get romantic, you could say, okay, that's where Atlantis was, and so it the prime meridian starts at Atlantis and works its way around. Now, I don't know. There's several different ways you could do prime meridians. You could run it through the Omphalos in Greece. You could run it through Jerusalem if you were really medieval. I mean, you know, or you could run it through the pyramids. And that there's some good argument for that. And by the way, if you look at Solarius's projection, you'll see that Taurus, where the zodiac actually starts, the Taurus. Aldebaran is right smack in ancient Egypt, very close to the pyramids. So I think Solarius, who knows what was in his mind when he did this. Also, too, the Great Bear happens to be walking across Siberia. Ah, that's, the Russian bear, and the Great Bear is walking across. It's a fascinating idea, and as I say, it's important to our Soma Sophia Celestial Magic project. Anyway, Solarius's Atlas of the Heavens is a beautiful, beautiful book, and those of you who are, really into celestial magic or want to really... get into it. I really recommend the book. It's expensive. It's touching in the Netherlands, and it's got a lot of German text in it and Dutch text, but they also have enough English. Everything, all the important text is also in English. So don't let that worry you. And Urania's mirror is very useful and in celestial magic. And whichever particular version of that you'd like. And even though I'm a bit suspicious of Zoroaster's telescope, I imagine there are people out there that probably think, oh, well, this is not that hard to understand. So, give it a try, see if you can figure it out. I don't know whether you need to spend $3,000 for a set. I think you can probably make them yourself. So that about wraps us up for tonight. Now, next week, next week, we're going to get into something really, another one of these big heavy books that takes two people to carry it. We're going to discuss of Carl Gustav Jung. And this is something that that is absolutely amazing and will become as a great surprise to a number of you, that you didn't realize that Carl Jung created his own grimoire with beautiful, beautiful illustrations, mandalas and illustrations that he did, and his own calligraphy. Of course, his calligraphy is all in German, but fortunately we have an English translation of it. And this book is the red book, almost as big as this, Solarius's Atlas, but it's just really magnificent. So next week, the red book. And until then, good magic.